this transition is happening. We don't have any control over it. We just need to adapt and respond. And the time for us to be proactive about it is running out, because it's something that's been happening, you know, over the last 10 years or so. And it's really gaining momentum on a daily basis now. So trade unions at this point in time, I would say, you know, they aren't really coming to party. And I think they should be advocating for new sectors that are going to emerge. Their role should be looking at what sectors are going to come out or are coming out by running their own studies as trade unions, you know, as representative of workers in the employment sector. They should be contributing towards supporting the government in looking at what economic sectors are emerging.
Hello and welcome to Earthcast, a platform for discussions about bridging the resource gap between people and planet. I am your host, Olivia Taylor, or Olivia Earth on the socials. I have the privilege of interviewing a series of changemakers, thinkers, and disruptors, and asking them about their fields of interest. Together, we will discover fresh perspectives and the most useful levers in society for change. More specifically, we will look at how to solve wicked problems and make decisions at the margin. If you would like to hear more from Earthcast, subscribe and follow us on social media. Earthcast Season 1 explores the just energy transition and unpacks varied topics such as finance, policy, deepening inclusivity, innovative technology, and how to accelerate the transition given climate limitations. Thanks for listening in to Episode 25, Season 1. Today, I'm excited to be introducing Batandwa Vazi, who is a qualified town and regional planner with an honours degree in public administration and an MBA. She is an established professional with 10 years of experience in local and provincial government across South Africa, advising and supporting them on best practices, as well as developing various plans and strategies, including climate action plans and revenue enhancement strategies. Batandwa's experience broadly ranges across sustainable energy and climate change approaches in urban development. This includes the areas of local-level energy data and policy development, energy efficiency, renewable energy, informal sector electrification, and related local government structures, mandates, and project implementation. This includes capacity building, facilitation, training, a learning network, and materials development specifically towards the reskilling of professionals in the area of local government and sustainable energy. So, Batandwa, question one, what was the benefit of completing your MBA after having had work experience, opposed to going straight into your MBA after your postgrad? And what specific experiences can you share that culminated in your choosing to pursue this career?
Thank you, Olivia, and thanks for having me. I guess the benefit of having to do a master's degree after you have had some experience is that, you know, going through the content, it was, I guess I was dealing with content that I had experience with, so it was familiar, but at the same time, it was also enlightening, because you get a bit of depth in some of the things that you have done. Say, for example, management, you get a bit of depth and different management styles. And obviously working within a government space and having to do an MBA, which is, as much as it's designed for all management, but it focuses a lot more on the business side of things. So having to apply the business approach within a government environment was also interesting. And it kind of forces you to think outside the box, because it has a lot to do with the economy, micro and macro. There's a lot around knowledge management and how you go about doing that, obviously from a management perspective. So I guess I wouldn't have been able to, because it's an MBA, you know, and it's not a subject specific, you know, unlike other master's degrees. Yeah, I wouldn't have been able to, I guess, cope with it as much as I was able to, because I had had work experience. Yeah. I don't know about culminating of other experiences, but I think in a nutshell, I'd say it has kind of groomed me around management and around entrepreneurship as well, in terms of how I would go about establishing a business and maybe even supporting other business owners as well, in terms of how they can deal with strategy and marketing and operations and management of, you know, the day-to-day, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot, actually. There's a lot.
Thank you so much for answering that. I think it was particularly important for me to ask, because I'm seeing a lot of young people coming out of their postgraduate degrees and feeling such pressure to continue studying because of the lack of job opportunities. So thank you for explaining that. That's been really useful. And so for the second question, what do you think the impact of decommissioning coal mines will be on the SA economy, on the South African economy? You know, what are the job concerns surrounding the transition to renewables? And what is the potential for job opportunities, both during development and during the production of renewable energy projects?
Well, you know, with regards to the decommissioning of the mines, that is national government responsibility at the moment. And obviously Eskom, because Eskom is a national government entity. And I guess the ripple effect of that at the moment, with what has been explored with the Just Energy Transition draft framework currently, and all the other engagements that have been led by the Presidential Climate Commission, it's to sort of look at what the effects are going to be in Mpumalanga, because that's where all the coal mines are. So there haven't really been much in terms of looking at the overall ripple effect. And recently we were involved in a Just Energy Transition research that was looking at that specifically in terms of translating what that process is going to be like for local government and how it should be unfolding for local government, but at the same time, how cities and municipalities should be looking at responding. So basically, we looked at the different industries that are going to be impacted. And one of those industries is the automotive industry. And obviously, it's a very broad industry, because you have your car manufacturing, and then you have your the petroleum side of things. So largely that market or that sector employs general workers and semi-skilled workers. You do have your skilled and your technical, but it's only a fraction of that market. So largely, those people in that market are semi-skilled and non-skilled. So because they don't have a lot of skills, you're looking at having to look at how the market is going to change and how the sector, you know, how the energy sector is going to change and how that is going to impact different economic sectors that will emerge. So for example, you're also looking at your electric vehicles that are coming in, and the national government is making a lot of pronunciations around that. You are also looking at the energy transition from a generation perspective. So you want to look at the economy from that angle. So all these new sectors or all these emerging sectors, and what space or what opportunity can they provide in terms of new job opportunities, and what skills are going to be needed? So for example, if you're looking at electric vehicles, you're looking at charging stations, you're looking at increasing electricity capacity at the moment, because mostly our electricity is still coming from the coal powered fire stations, power stations. You still having to look at a transport sector transitioning, but powered by coal, right? So, and mostly you want to have renewable energy also coming into effect to power some of those transitions. So once I guess we reached a point of parity between the amount of renewable energy generated into the system and the amount of coal energy that is sort of leaving the system, then I guess that's when we'll be able to tell in terms of the new job opportunities that will be coming in. So how much, say, for example, solar panels do we need in the country? With the once the charging stations start being rolled out, how many operators do we need? How many technicians do we need for that? How is the petroleum sector going to transition as well? You know, previously last week we were at the city of Johannesburg, and we were basically having those engagements. And one thing that came up was, so for the petroleum sector to also not be left behind, they also need to be looking at how do they retrofit, so to speak, the petrol filling stations with electric vehicle chargers. Because over time, and I mean, the projections that were made in that session were in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years, because also with what's currently happening with Russia and Ukraine, the European countries are like fast moving into really scraping off petroleum-powered vehicles, and so the transition is happening at a much quicker pace than it would have if it wasn't for what's happening right now with the Ukraine and Russia. So that's going to impact us as well. I mean, it's already impacting us with petrol prices, but it's also forcing us to really think quickly, and it's forcing us to really move quickly around the transition. Yeah, I feel like I've gone into... I've gone into it a bit there, but it's just basically going to open up new opportunities in the economy, and both the private sector and the public sector need to be prepared for it, and they need to start projecting for those new opportunities, as well as bringing in the private sector, for example, with those sectors that are going to be affected, your automotive, your petroleum, and any other, to start thinking about reskilling their employees and looking at what skills are going to be needed so that a lot of jobs that are projected to be lost aren't necessarily lost at the amount projected, but rather you have a transition both from an energy perspective, economy perspective, but also at a job perspective or employment perspective.
Thank you so much for explaining that so succinctly and managing to go into such depth as well. And I hear that perhaps you are quite optimistic about this, which is good, which is really reassuring.
I guess we don't have any other choice but to be optimistic. The effect is going to be there, especially for, you know, for Mpumalanga, because having been there just recently as well, you can see how their economy is really centered around the coal mines that are there, because there's a lot of the power stations, the Eskom power stations. I think their head office is also centered there. So you can see how the economy has really developed around those mines. So it's really imperative for Eskom to really think about it very, they need to be very careful and about how they move in terms of the decommissioning process. And also with the decommissioning, it is in the integrated resource plan, the 2019, which was projecting, decommissioning to happen at a gradual pace. And I guess looking at your 2030, 2050 scale. So it is something that is happening, but as you can see, it hasn't necessarily started because they're still trying to respond to the challenges that are happening at the moment with their power stations. So you can see that it's not something that has started, as much as there has been that procurement process for, I'm not sure, bid window, whether it's bid window 6, for new generation capacity to come again from your independent power producers into the grid. So that is happening, but it obviously, because it's still in procurement, etc., we don't know when that generation capacity will really come into effect. It might be end of this year or sometime next year. So yeah, we are talking about decommissioning of the coal mines, but it's something that hasn't really started happening. And I guess because it hasn't really started happening, they need to be quite careful in terms of how they plan for it, especially for the province of Mpumalanga, and what new job opportunities can come out of that as well.
Let's talk further then about energy access and energy poverty and inclusivity. Where do the trade-offs lie, in your opinion, with regard to scalable solutions for communities to enjoy clean, reliable, and affordable energy?
Well, you know, with the way that our energy system has been designed, or our power system has been designed in the country, it's been largely monopolized up until maybe 8-10 years or even recent, where we started looking at small-scale embedded generation, and that is when communities started participating in this, you know, quite monopolized sector by being able to install these smaller solar systems for their own personal use. But it then opened up an opportunity, and it opened up a new sort of sector within the energy sector where, you know, municipalities and ESCOM and the government needed to start thinking around bringing in other players into the space and guess decentralizing to a certain extent the monopoly that ESCOM has had in the sector. It also ushered in an opportunity for municipalities to really start looking at energy as not just as a utility where they sell kilowatt hours, but as a business unit, where, you know, within a business unit you have you provide services, but you diversify within that you know, service package that you're providing. So they needed to diversify in allowing consumers to generate and looking at the different pricing methodologies around that, you know. So it was no longer going to be the normal tariff that they are charged, but they had to look at incentivizing it so that consumers are encouraged to do their own installations. But it also pushed municipalities to look at their revenue model at a different lens, in that if you have consumers now generating their own electricity, how is it going to impact the kilowatt hours that were sold that are no longer going to be sold? So in a way, it opened up an opportunity even for lower income households that may not have the capital to do their own installations, but rather can lead or can drive engagements around being included in, you know, the embedded generation part of, you know, the energy sector at local level. So municipalities now starting to generate their own electricity at a local level is also opening space for them to engage communities with, you know, not just energy access, but also energy efficiency, you know, because at the moment we are having a strained energy system. So you want to start talking about energy efficiency and how it improves or how it sort of sustains or assists in terms of conserving your energy within the home space. So it has also opened up a discussion around how do you improve access to low-income communities, clean energy access, right? So municipalities starting to generate their own energy then opens up a space into where they look at, if we are able to generate our own power, how much are we saving from what we used to spend purchasing bulk energy from ESCOM? Because that process in itself has a lot of charges, and municipalities are actually overcharged in some instances by ESCOM. So if they're able to cut that out, or they're able to, say, minimize that, or yeah, have a fraction of that removed by their own generation capacity, it means that they are able to save more. So now the theory around that is, once you are saving more, does it mean that you are able to judge less amount for energy, so less tariffs or tariff per kilowatt, especially for the lower income households? Do you also, look at cross subsidies with your higher income households that are, say, not necessarily getting off the grid, but they are also providing their own generation capacity within their homes, whether it's their homes or their businesses? So how are you going to manage that cross subsidy thing to improve access, but also to make access affordable for those who cannot afford? But also now, what's emerging is, your community-owned energy or community-led, socially owned energy, where communities are sort of coming together to look at possible models and approaches where they can advocate and lobby for the government and for the municipalities to really push around developing, I'll say, mini grids within their own communities. So basically just building onto what's already been happening, but having a community focus, a community angle to it, where they are now going to drive for the municipalities to really look at having these small systems or medium sized systems of up to 100 megawatts installed in their communities. And in what role are they going to play in that whole process? Are they going to be shareholders? Are they going to be partners? But at the same time, it really opens up, that whole thing that's been technical for the longest time, that's existed in a cloud, so to speak. You never knew where electricity came from. You just came into your home and you switched on the light and it was on. All you needed to do was pay your bill at the end of the month, or all you needed to do was to go and purchase units at a shop or wherever. So now it's an engagement process, but it's also an educational process where people are really starting to embrace the fact that they are shareholders in the grid itself, because the grid is a public, it's publicly owned, it's a public asset. So we never really knew that, we actually own the grid as citizens, because it's a public asset. We never knew that, but we also never knew how, because we are never included in the whole running of it, and whether it's generation, whether it's transmission or distribution. But now we get to play a role, even if we are playing a role at the last end, which is your distribution part. We also get to play a role in how electricity is generated, but we also get to play a role around this energy transition, because now we're not talking about generating energy from coal or any other source. We are specifically talking about generating energy from clean sources, your sun and your wind. So I guess in a nutshell, what I would say is that where we are right now, the transition has ushered in, really pushing the decentralization of the energy sector. And now we are at a point where communities are also starting to play a very significant role in that process.
Just before I go on to the next question, which is actually going to talk about decentralization in communities, yeah, I wanted to just say that was insane. Thank you so much. I was actually going to ask you a question about renewable energy and SACGs later, small-scale embedded generation, and how they perhaps threaten ESCOM's model. Mm-hmm. And now you've mentioned mini-grids as well, so I'm really interested, although I think you have answered that question, because I was going to ask, how does ESCOM need to adapt and stay efficient, relevant, and become profitable? But, how in practice can power be decentralized to communities in a way which enables them to play a role in the just energy transition?
The only way to do that, Olivia, is through local government, right? Remember in the beginning I said this whole thing is still happening at a national level, and obviously ESCOM being a national entity. So we really need to bring it down to the local level. And the one way that communities can play that role is through municipalities, and through municipalities actually engaging them. So what's happening now is, through community-based organizations, and some projects are coming up that are looking at empowering communities. So communities are empowering themselves on the side And municipalities are also, you know, trying to develop these localized policies around energy generation at a local stance, transmission and distribution. Obviously, transmission is another monster altogether. But at the moment, we're looking at generation and we're looking at distribution, right? So the next feasible thing to do is for communities to engage municipalities, but also municipalities to engage communities. So what has happened in the past is that there is that disjuncture between the communication that exists between municipalities and communities, where because of the model that we've had where municipalities were selling kilowatt hours. And I guess this runs across to Eskom as well, because you would note that there's been very minimal engagement up until recently, where you have Eskom having your press releases and updating people. But even when this load shedding started years and years ago, there was never any engagement. We were never appraised of what's happening and why it's happening. We would always just get notified that there's going to be load shedding, right? So now you can see that they are opening up that line of engagement, even if it's through media and even social media as well, where communities, which is you and me, and anyone on the street and anyone who has access to Twitter or any other media form, are able to share. We are able to share our opinions. We're able to share our frustrations. But at the same time, we're all also able to share what we think should happen. So because that is at a national level, it's kind of difficult to extract and act on, you know, ideas and engagements that are happening on the ground directly through a national entity or a national department. So that's why now you're finding that they are sort of trying to develop some policy, which is your Just Energy Transition framework, which I think eventually will be translated into some green paper, white paper, and maybe a policy at the end of the day. And that's how national works. So for local, because local is more empowered to you know, act quite radical or quite immediate as opposed to national, that's where the community engagement really needs to happen. So not just communities empowering themselves and then approaching municipalities to actually have a say, but municipalities really need to beef up and diversify how they engage with communities. I think a nice way of looking at it, or a nice maybe case to think about, is the recent Tshwane ya Tima campaign, where the city of Tshwane ran a campaign on all the customers that have been owing the municipality over the years. And they, in a way, that campaign was sort of galvanizing support for the municipality to be able to do what it's supposed to do. Because previously, municipalities have sort of not been able to switch off power, especially for government buildings and for big business, you know. They've sort of not been able to, and it's been a political thing going on. But I think for them running that campaign, they sort of had the public support, right? Because we're always getting news reports around municipalities owing this and municipalities not being able to provide their services, etc. But we never know why, you know. And a large part of that is because the revenue for municipalities comes from electricity sales. A large part of the revenue, I think electricity is the second largest revenue source for municipalities after rates. So by them not being able to collect, it means it cripples their ability to provide services. So by them running that campaign, they were able to sort of get the sympathy and empathy of the community. But it was also a way for them to open up that engagement process, where they are able to provide an explanation of, you know, we've collected this much, we've collected this much, and this is going to be diverted into, you know, beefing up service delivery here, or beefing up that, or beefing up that. So you are now starting to see a building of trust, you know, regaining of trust between consumer and municipality, which is quite pivotal in being able to then bring in communities within this energy generation space. Because if communities don't trust the municipality or they don't trust government to deliver, then this whole thing that we are trying to do is not going to happen, you know? So communities need to trust the government, but also the government needs to bring in and engage communities at every step of the way. Say, for example, if now Tshwane was to say they are going to develop a solar plant or a solar farm somewhere in Tshwane or somewhere in the township, because there's already that medium of communication that has been opened up, you know, they could still run another campaign to educate the community around what the solar plant is about, how much capacity is going to bring into the local grid, you know, what impacts is it going to have, et cetera, et cetera. So now you're starting to see the municipality bringing in communities. You know, there's various ways that that could go. They could invite communities to community meetings to engage with them and for communities to raise their concerns, etc. So basically what I'm saying is you need to open an engagement channel between the two parties. And the best way for the just energy transition to really be realized within our country is to empower municipalities to be able to do that. Because at the end of the day, it's municipalities that are closest to us. You know, the policy making can happen at a national level. The decommissioning can happen at a national level. But at the local level, where you really get to see the impacts of your job losses, of your load shedding, or of your service delivery breakdown, that's where it needs to happen. And I do believe that that's where the impact of just transition can actually be realized as well.
But Tanbo, what do you think should be the role that trade unions play in the just energy transition? Should they campaign for creating renewable energy jobs, or are they limiting the progress due to fear over losing mining jobs and the effort involved with re- or upskilling?
You know, I think the role of trade unions, and this is my own personal opinion based on observation of what has been happening in the country, it has deteriorated in the sense that you kind of don't see trade unions really speak in defense of workers. And I'm saying this in that, you know, this transition is happening. We don't have any control over it. We just need to adapt and respond. And the time for us to be proactive about it is running out, because it's something that's been happening, you know, over the last 10 years or so. And it's really gaining momentum on a daily basis now. So trade unions at this point in time, I would say, you know, they aren't really coming to party. And I think they should be advocating for new sectors that are going to emerge. Their role should be looking at what sectors are going to come out or are coming out by running their own studies as trade unions, you know, as representative of workers in the employment sector. They should be contributing towards supporting the government in looking at what economic sectors are emerging, what companies are coming into the economic space or the South African space that either renewable energy generators or manufacturers of parts that are used within renewable energy sector. They should be looking at, you know, we talked about the automotive sector being greatly impacted. They should be the ones leading the discussion and perhaps policy that will encourage new entrants into the automotive sector that are looking at either green fuels or green vehicles, etc. And what skills are required there? You know, what infrastructure is going to be required? You know, do we need to retrofit? Do we need... So I guess in summary, what I'm saying is that trade unions really need to be playing a leading role in guiding the employment sector in what is currently happening, rather than sort of trying to safeguard mining jobs and sort of speak against the energy transition. They should be supporting the government in finding solutions around new employment opportunities that may come out. Even with the coal mining decommissioning, they should be leading the discussion around what Eskom should be doing to sort of safeguard the projected mine jobs that are going to be lost. So looking at what Eskom should be doing, you know, around whether they, you know, there was a discussion a while back where the CEO of Eskom was mentioning that some of the power stations that are decommissioned or that will no longer be running can be used as space to actually install solar. And I don't know whether they were embarking on a feasibility study of how much solar can actually be installed there, or how much solar panels can be installed there, and how much capacity can be generated, you know, and what spaces are around those power stations can be used, you know. So there's a lot, there is a lot that can be looked into and that can be done that should be led by the trade unions. Yeah, and yes, I do agree that they should be campaigning for renewable energy jobs, and they also should be campaigning for upskilling. And the only way that they would know what skills are going to be required is for them to play a part in the research that is currently unfolding. You know, TIPS is doing a lot of that at the moment. And I think some other sectors, like your transport sector, is sort of starting to do that as well. So they need to be, you know, we need to be the ones drawing from them and whatever studies that they are undertaking as, you know, representatives of the employment sector to say, okay, this is emerging. This is where you could potentially employ this number of people. These are the skills that are required. And these are the players that need to, you know, take up that role in upskilling these people, et cetera. These are the new areas that will require perhaps new academic qualifications, for example. You know, I strongly believe that IT and anything that relates to technology, whether it's artificial intelligence or augmented reality, etc., is going to play a really big role in terms of the future that we are going into. So those are the spaces that they need to be playing a role in and finding opportunities in to sort of support the government in providing solutions for the employment sector.
I have so enjoyed listening to you. And before I ask you the last question, where can everyone listening follow more of your work? Where can you lead us to? What social media handle?
Okay, so I think it would be best that they follow Sustainable Energy Africa on LinkedIn. But for more information around, you know, climate action response, mitigation, which is your renewable energy, you know, the energy transition, and many other exciting projects and programs that are currently unfolding in the country that my organization is currently leading and partnering with other significant organizations as well in the country. Yeah, so they should follow the LinkedIn handle. And I think from the LinkedIn handle, they'll be able to access the website. There is also a few resource portals that we have. There is Urban Energy, and I think it's urbanenergy.org.za, where they can access a lot of information around, you know, your climate action, climate mitigation, renewable energy, the capacity that's currently happening, capacity building of, you know, your municipalities and some of the projects that involve communities and the just energy transition. Yeah, but in my personal capacity, people can follow me on Twitter. It's called The Music Binger. And on LinkedIn, I'm Batando Vazi. So for anything that has to do with, you know, content, professional content that I currently do in my workspace, they should follow me on LinkedIn. And anything else, it's on Twitter.
Thank you so much. So last question. Given your expertise, what question should I have asked you?
Wow. I actually think you have asked me everything, you know. Perhaps we could have talked about, you know, how the just energy transition fits into the climate action planning that's also happening in the country. You know, how is that happening? You know, especially considering the fact that we are seeing climate impacts in KZN, you know. I mean, KZN is the recent of many climate impacts that the country has experienced. You know, the long-standing drought that, you know, even Cape Town was affected by not so long ago was a climate impact, climate change impact. There's been other flooding occurrences that have happened in not so recent, not so long ago, in the country, along the coast. So it just basically says a lot in how, you know, everything else that we've discussed really goes back to where the country is and where everyone is in terms of their climate change knowledge and what it means for us. You know, a lot of people talk about multinational organizations playing a role in the emissions that are basically causing all these climate change impacts and were the impacts that we are experiencing. And that at an individual level, there's only so much we can do. But it also doesn't change the fact that we need to educate ourselves, we need to educate our communities and our children, and how important it is that we transition into cleaner energy, because then we are going to be reducing the amount of emissions that are released in the atmosphere and hopefully reversing, you know, the climate change impacts that we are experiencing now by reducing the increasing temperatures. So if we are able to do that, you know, then I think the bigger discussion on just energy transition, you know, everything else that we've talked about, you know, finds the space, it finds a source, it finds its roots. So we are able to understand where it's all coming from and where it should be going.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Next episode, I will be asking more creatives and intellectual disruptors about making decisions at the margin. See you next time.